stepping strutters who land in the gutter sometime need one too. Take it or leave it, or try to believe it, if you've been down too long. Rainy day lovers don't hide love inside, they just pass it on. They just pass it on.
Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will start and take a look at Canadian media and what is being described as their willful blindness when it comes to the reality of Palestinians under occupation. There was a time when we needed to make an effort to know what is really happening to Palestinians beyond the fog of disinformation created by the Israeli propaganda. But today it's the contrary. Considering the widespread and widely accessible evidence of the ongoing genocide against Palestinians, some even filmed and documented by Israeli soldiers themselves, it actually takes an effort to not see and not know the crimes committed by the Israeli government against Palestinians. Yet, Canadian media seems to still be conveniently oblivious to the situation. We will start the show by looking at some of the reasons why. Then we will move to Israel and see what are the goals of the Israeli government in Gaza, why the Israeli society is still willing to tolerate and support their government in this never-ending war endeavor, and how much Israeli media is playing a role in that consent. After, we will come back to Canada and cover a protest that took place in Ottawa when more than 150 activists occupied the Canadian Parliament, demanding the Canadian government stop supplying weapons to the Israeli government. We will end this show in the Arab world and start with a look at the ceasefire in Lebanon. After being consistently violated by Israel since it took effect last week, we ask how really reliable is the ceasefire? Will it actually hold? And finally, we will see what are the potential long-term effects of the complete inaction of the Arab governments for the past year while a genocide is taking place next door. Will there be any consequences caused eventually by the pent-up frustrations of the populations of these Arab countries? Stay tuned.
This is the Palestine Debrief Podcast, a production of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. I'm your host, Wissam Sheikh Hassan. Several of the topics recorded on Palestine Debrief Podcast revolved around Canadian media biases. We've spoken to Zahra Al-Akhras and her firing from Global following the CBC whistleblower article published in The Breach. Text Role and Genocide with Paul Bigger touches on a topic, and more recently with Jason Toney in the episode titled Challenging the Media's Palestine Exception. So we're all well aware that bias is significant in how it shapes Canadian media coverage of events in Palestine. We are more likely to hear the Israeli perspectives, including Israel's claim that it's winning the war in Gaza, rather than a Palestinian perspective of what is actually happening on the ground. This is especially true when it comes to military reporting. To provide an alternative perspective that is not found in traditional media outlets, we interviewed John Elmer, a Canadian writer and photojournalist that specializes in the Middle East and Canadian foreign and military policy. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Wissam.
I want to start in the beginning on your personal experience. And as someone who spent significant amount of time in Palestine, I want to know how that experience shaped your views. You're aware that as an Arab and as a Palestinian, we look at the conflict and we look at what's happening in a very different lens as what, you know, the so-called Western world does. And I want to know how that affected you and what shift in perspectives happened.
Yeah, I mean, I started my journalism career in the West Bank and Gaza when I was pretty young. And so I lived there during the Second Intifada. I lived in Jenin, Gaza City. I lived in Rafah for a time. And so unquestionably that shaped my understanding of the conflict. I lived, like I said, in Jenin. I didn't live in Jerusalem and travel for the day to Jenin. I lived there during the Second Intifada, during, you know, weeks long curfew, street fighting, constant attacks. And so my understanding of the conflict comes for sure from those experiences. And those it couldn't be further from the framing that you get in the Western media, of course, largely because the journalists don't experience that. Even if they're the Jerusalem bureau chief, they're not spending the night. They're not spending the days living in and out, the day in and day out life of what Palestinians live under occupation. So both in terms of the conflict, what it's like to live in conflict permanently, what it's like to have your life uprooted at any given moment by the occupation, you know, the quiet occupation that doesn't make the news every day, but also, of course, the fighting that just, you know, shapes every interaction that Palestinians have with the outside world. So there's no doubt that having that experience roots my understanding of this conflict in that. And, you know, of course, my experience is not the same as Palestinians. I have a significant amount of privilege when I'm, you know, even reporting from Jenin. But I saw it day in, day out. I went to school, walked to school with the kids in the morning and saw what it's like to be under curfew and to have your school day uprooted and turn into a street conflict at the whims of the military occupation. What it's like to try to raise a family, what it's like to try to run a business, just the basic elements of life are completely at the whims of the military occupation at any given moment. Second Intifada was a daily grind for Palestinians, particularly in Jenin. You know, curfew completely shuts down daily life. You're not allowed into the streets. In many cases, the Israeli military treats that situation as a shoot to kill. And that's the whole nature of curfew. And that defined an entire generation of Palestinians, you know, from the beginning of the Second Intifada in 2000 until 2005. I mean, once the Israelis reoccupied the West Bank in 2002, the occupation became a permanent presence in everyday life for Palestinians. So, you know, growing up in that, you know, with that experience, there's no question it gives me a richer understanding of the grind of a military occupation that I think is absent from the Western media, even though, you know, say the CBC had correspondents there and I would bump into them from time to time, but their experience is based in Jerusalem. It's based in living, in Israeli society and just traveling, you know, even occasionally, to somewhere, that experiences the occupation day in and day out, hour by hour. And so you can't really, you know, replace that experience. Yeah, the media isn't looking for that experience. They're not looking for that understanding. And in many cases, the media sees that as a negative, right? They rotate correspondents out of an area once they've been there for a few years. The term in the media industry is, you know, going native. which basically is the idea that you understand the place well enough to understand the experience of the society. And then they move you on to London, you know, or Paris for your next assignment. So there's a structure in the media that prevents that kind of depth of understanding, I think.
Do you think that there's something about Palestine and the Arab world that the colonizers, the West, doesn't get or is unable to understand?
I mean, I think that they don't understand the fundamentals of a military occupation, of lacking, you know, self-determination, the, you know, inability to be able to shape your own life in the long term, and constant uprooting. I think it's something that the Western media has no interest in understanding. And I think if they did, we would have a much better understanding of what's going on in Palestine today.
And the context of that is that, I mean, they see themselves as the Israelis, as the colonizers. For them, they're constantly justifying whitewashing or downplaying what Israel is doing because it's their cultural heritage and their history.
Yeah, it's a settler colonial state. And, Canada sees a lot of itself in Israel. Israel sees a lot of itself in Canada, and these processes are very similar. And there's a structural unwillingness to understand the indigenous perspective, which I think is present in Canadian society as well. They see themselves in that society. They're propped up. I mean, Israel is propped up by Canadian and American governments and structures of understanding. They absolutely see themselves, and they see the Palestinians as the other, and that certainly defines the experience in Canada and in Israel.
Do you think that there's anything that they do right?
Canadian media in Palestine?
Yes.
No, I mean, very little. I mean, we're watching right now, with the nature of media today, we're watching Palestinians live streaming their own genocide. We're watching Israeli soldiers live stream their committing of genocide. All the information is there to be seen by anybody who wants to see it. If the media were to decide to take a critical lens on what's happening, all the information is there. It's a willful blindness. It's a structural blindness. There's never been more ability to understand or to see from the perspective of Palestinians what's been going on than in the social media era, in the era of the cell phone in every pocket of every person. You can see it. It takes an effort to not see it. And I think that's what we're really seeing in this past, 14 months of brutality that we've been seeing day in and day out. It takes a real effort to not understand or to not see what's happening, because it's not just the Palestinians that are, live streaming the genocide. It's the Israelis too. The Israeli chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, had to issue a memo in the, late December, early January, telling, Israeli soldiers, we're not on a genocide. You're not on a killing spree. Stop taking trophy videos. Stop looting. A year later, in Lebanon, we're seeing the exact same things, almost like a joy in the genocide, stealing women's clothes and children's toys, blowing up entire neighborhoods, with glee. All that information is there to be seen. You don't even have to go and travel to the place in the way that you did when I began my career, when reporters were, sort of a portal to understand another society. And we have all the tools today to see it from the Palestinian perspective and from the Israeli perspective. And so, it's unspeakable. This last year has been just a real mask off moment, beyond anything that anyone could have. I don't think there's any experience in Palestine that could prepare you or have you understand just the sheer scale of what we've been seeing in the last year is it's unbelievable.
The one thing that I find that the West doesn't understand, going back to the first question, is that we see resilience as victory. I think that was, it appeared several times in modern history, but I think Vietnam War is the one that comes to mind. As long as you're still existing, as long as that you're still there, then that's, you're still winning. You haven't lost. I think that's the biggest thing.
Yeah. And Palestinians, I mean, when you see it, and I saw it when I was living in the West Bank, you know, the Israelis would come through and destroy Jenin with their tanks, and then the tanks would leave town, and the first thing that happened is people come out and immediately start cleaning up the streets. We see it in Gaza too. The first moment they're able to return, the first thing they do is start to rebuild. Israel has dismantled the hospitals multiple times because the Palestinians immediately go back and rebuild the hospital system. They rebuild the education system. Their resilience and the courage of the civilians. We talk about the resistance, but the courage of the civilian population to carry on through this brutality and cruelty of the last 14 months. It's a symbol. It's a message to the rest of the world that I think. There's no going back for either. I don't think there's any going back for Israel, and there's no going back for Palestinians. They're on a trajectory for liberation that I think is irreversible, and their ability to stay in the fight and not be destroyed like Israel would have it is a significant accomplishment.
Appalling and apocalyptic, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' words to describe Israel's onslaught on Gaza over the past 14 months. That's killed more than 44,000 people. Those who survived the bombardment face hunger. Israel has repeatedly restricted humanitarian aid from entering Gaza and is accused by aid organizations and the UN of using starvation as a weapon of war. Aid agencies bringing in desperately needed humanitarian relief into Gaza have also been attacked. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has been forced to halt the delivery of aid through the key Kerem Abu Salem crossing between Israel and Gaza because of safety concerns for its staff.
The United Nations on a daily basis have been calling for the safe facility, not just of aid supplies, but also of our personnel. UNRWA has had 250 colleagues killed.
Hopes for a ceasefire in Gaza were slightly raised after the US President Joe Biden announced a truce between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon at the end of last month.
Just as the Lebanese people deserve a future of security and prosperity, so do the people of Gaza. They too deserve an end to the fighting and displacement. The people of Gaza have been through hell.
The US has restarted efforts to reach a ceasefire in Gaza ahead of the inauguration of Donald Trump as president in January, and urged Israel to do more to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian aid throughout Gaza.
We need to get a ceasefire. We need to see the hostages released. We need to implement plans for the day after that would allow or would establish governance, security, and reconstruction inside Gaza. And that ought to be an urgent priority, not just for the United States, not just for other countries in the region, but for Israel as well.
The Gulf Cooperation Council has reiterated its call for an immediate end to the war on Gaza.
The Supreme Council called for an end to the crimes of killing and collective punishment in Gaza, the displacement of the population, and the destruction of civilian facilities and infrastructure. The Council also called for intervention to protect civilians, stop the war, and sponsor serious negotiations to reach sustainable solutions.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has faced increasing domestic pressure to reach a deal with Hamas to secure the release of captives that have been held in Gaza for more than a year.
I turn to you, Prime Minister, in my name, in the name of my family, and in the name of the Israeli people, because all eyes are on you now, waiting for you to make a courageous decision.
US President-elect Donald Trump is reported to want a deal on a ceasefire in Gaza before he takes office in January next year, and has warned there will be, quote, hell to pay in the Middle East if captives held in Gaza are not released before his inauguration. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has repeatedly been accused of stalling negotiations until Trump moves into the White House. Mohammed Haji, Al Jazeera, for Inside Story.
Al Jazeera correspondent Tariq Abu Azoum sent us this update from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. He describes the plight of Palestinians after facing more than a year of violence.
It has been more than a year of relentless bombardment across the Gaza Strip, where the situation is growing more precarious by the day. Gaza civilians are incredibly caught in the grip of this ongoing soaring conflict on the ground that has no end in sight. They are not just overwhelmed by rubble and destruction, they are incredibly also struck by the high rates of famine that is taking place across many areas in the strip. The people of Gaza are quite simple. We have been speaking to them to listen to their dreams and hopes, and what we have found out was quite heartbreaking.
We want a truce today, not tomorrow. Have mercy on us. Our children are dying. They're dying from the garbage, from the Israelis, from the remnants of the occupation. We don't know what to do. We are unable to find something to eat or drink.
The vast majority of Gaza's population have completely been suffering from one of the worst impending humanitarian crises ever recorded in modern history. They have completely run out of options and means to survive in light of the latest UN decision to suspend aid deliveries to the Gaza Strip due to safety concerns. And now what they have only is a glimmer of hope for the success of the current round of negotiations in Cairo in order to bring an end for their ongoing soaring agony on the ground. For Gaza civilians, future is quite uncertain, and even the wait for peace seems to be endless. Tariq Abu Azoum, Al Jazeera for Inside Story, Deir al-Balah, Palestine.
Well, let's bring in our panel of guests to discuss all this further. In Washington, D.C., we have Jihad Abu Salem, Executive Director of the Institute for Palestine Studies. In Tel Aviv, Gideon Levy is a columnist at the Haaretz newspaper. And in Doha, Omar Rahman is a fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs. Thank you, all of you, for joining us here on this edition of Inside Story. It was a week ago that we had that ceasefire signed involving Hezbollah and Israel. It's a very shaky ceasefire, but it's still holding right now. At the time, there was some hope expressed that maybe there could also be a ceasefire in Gaza. Let me start with you, Jihad. What has been preventing a ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, thank you for having me. The entire world is united in calling for an end to this senseless bloodshed in Gaza. President-elect Trump, the Arab nations, the Palestinian factions, everyone is aligned on the need to stop the bloodshed and rebuild Gaza and allow Gaza to heal. The Palestinian side has developed a comprehensive vision for what comes after the war and after halting this genocide. This vision is rooted in national consensus, and it's endorsed by nearly all factions, and it corresponds with key international efforts to stop the killing. And of course, as I mentioned, this vision isn't just Palestinian. It has widespread Arab support, including from states that have relations with Israel. So the question then is, why does Israel keep saying no to ending the violence? And I think, you know, this is important because ending the war could potentially expose Netanyahu to accountability at home, and ending the war could challenge the agenda of extremist elements in Netanyahu's government that are pushing for ethnic cleansing and annexation. They want to settle Gaza. They're talking about it. It's explicit, and you know, it's clear what's happening. This isn't about Israeli security. It's about advancing a dangerous settler agenda, and I believe this is what's preventing a ceasefire from taking place in Gaza.
Let's get the perspective from Gideon in Tel Aviv. What is Israel actually achieving militarily right now? Because it's killed Hamas's most senior commanders. What is the Israeli military actually achieving?
Nothing and nothing, except of more killing and keeping the Israeli government in power, which is the main goal right now. I would like to be very clear, James. I know what might happen, but I know much more what will not happen. Israel is not going to withdraw from Gaza. There are no plans for it. On the contrary, the infrastructure that Israel is building now in Gaza is like 1,000 proofs to the assumption that Israel is there to stay. And the ethnic cleansing of the southern, of the northern part of Gaza is like 1,000 proof to the fact that Israel will or might settle in the northern part of Gaza. Having said all this, there might be a kind of an interim agreement very soon with release of some hostages and some kind of truce, but forget about withdrawal from Gaza, and those are the worst news we can think about.
Omar, do you share that view that Israel wants to put new settlements, particularly in northern Gaza? There has been a siege going on there now for more than 50 days. Supplies are not getting in. The UN is not getting in.
Well, I think there are differences of opinion within the current government. There are certainly elements within the government on the far right that want to resettle Gaza. I think there were others, even the one, the defense minister that was dismissed, that were more hesitant to put settlements. But all of them, I think, have been united by the desire from day one to pulverize Gaza, destroy it, and ethnically cleanse the Gaza Strip. I think there were limits to that because of Egypt closing the border, but there's a determination to do that to the northern part of Gaza and to maintain a long-term Israeli military presence in the Gaza Strip that they can use to control the rest and put pressure on the population to dwindle over time. I think that's been the overriding objective. That's why we haven't seen a ceasefire, because the Israelis have not wanted that. Netanyahu's government has not wanted that in order to pursue this agenda. And so I think the ceasefire negotiations that have happened over the past 14 months have always been not serious because of Netanyahu and his goals.
The pressure points on the Netanyahu government, one is U.S. leverage, and they haven't used it, the Biden administration, because clearly they could cut all of the funding and all the military aid if they wanted to. But the other one over the last 14 months has been those that were taken by Hamas more than a year ago, those that are being held. We think just over 60 may still be alive. Now, their families and Israeli public opinion was pushing pressure on Netanyahu. Have those people now been forgotten?
Politically, yes. Publicly, not. But politically, it's not only they were forgotten. They were never remembered by Netanyahu and his government. This is not his political base. And from the beginning, he could ignore the protest and solidarity of many Israelis because that's not his political basis. And therefore, he ignored them, and he can continue to ignore them, even though it is really a horrible tragedy for so many people. But the other leverage, namely the American administration, is right now a big mystery. Because even Donald Trump, when he speaks about ending the war, which he likes to see, does not speak about withdrawal from Gaza. So I will not exclude the situation in which Israel will declare ceasefire and remain in Gaza, which means a war forever in Gaza, because the resistance will never agree that Israel will reconquer Gaza and maybe even resettle Gaza. So I'm not sure that Donald Trump is a source of hope. There is one reason why we should hope from him more than from Biden. Netanyahu could easily ignore Biden. He will not be able to ignore Donald Trump. The question is, what will Donald Trump tell to Israel, and what measures will he take if Israel will not follow his instructions or advices or threats or whatever? And the very few days will show what is the direction. But one thing must be clear, there will be no peace in Gaza when Israel stays there. This we have to repeat again and again, because I have this feeling that someone in the American administration, all those Israel lovers around Donald Trump, who most of them are more radical than the most radical settlers in Israel, some of them might think that the peace in Gaza means the remain of Israel in Gaza, and that's out of the question.
Generally, the feeling is that Israel and Israeli, settlers, the Israeli citizens, tend to not have a very high tolerance to casualties. Do you think that the Israeli military and the Israeli people can sustain much longer? There are no numbers reported on Israeli casualties on the Gaza front and Lebanon front, but do you think they can sustain much longer?
I mean, I think long term, this is going to lead to the downfall of Israel if they continue on this trajectory. They don't have the military, they don't have the population to sustain an endless war. October 7th gave them a bit of a higher tolerance for casualties, but like you said, they don't give honest casualty numbers, clearly because they believe the morale in their society can't handle those numbers. The military censor, which is something I don't think a lot of Western observers understand, the military censor has total control over all information that comes out. So if they don't want casualty statistics to come out, those casualty statistics don't come out. They position someone from the spokesperson, IDF spokesperson unit in every hospital in Israel to prevent the information from coming out. There's lots of indications that that Israel can't handle this long term economically. In materiel, their society is a conscription army. Their reserve army pulls, their soldiers out of their economy. So that puts their economy at risk. I mean, they've made it the most dangerous place in the world for Jews to be. They have not made it a place where, settlers would be encouraged to go. So long-term strategy of allowing your people to be captured and to just give the, sacrifice them so that you can carry out a TikTok genocide doesn't seem to me to be a long-term, self-preservation strategy. Economically, Israel's not economically able to maintain a constant war. This goes against all of Israel's previous military doctrine of fighting, short wars, on other people's territory. I'm not going to tell Israel how to run a state that preserves itself, but this doesn't look like the way to do it. So I think they're caught up in a moment where they never believed they would have this amount of support and leeway to carry out this destruction and to extend it to Lebanon now. I don't think that even Israel expected that. I don't think we're seeing a strategic plan by Israel. I think that's quite clear that they are just unraveling day by day the strategy based on how much leeway they're given by their backers.
And Guy, I wanted to ask you about the International Criminal Court's historic decision to indict Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. In a statement, the ICC said that the Israeli leaders had, quote, intentionally and knowingly deprived the civilian population in Gaza of objects indispensable to their survival. How was this news received within Israel? And do you think it will have in the long term a major impact on Netanyahu and the policies of his government?
Well, thank you, Han. One of the most heartbreaking realities of the situation is that Israelis
don't get the news that everyone else in the world is getting, the images from Bitlahia and from Jabalia, the just atrocities we're seeing there, the death, the destruction, the starvation, that is not being shown on Israeli television, Israeli newspapers. And therefore, when something like this comes out, a decision from the ICC, basically they're response from wall to wall. We're talking about the entire Zionist politics. So that's about 110 out of 120 members of the Knesset are just saying this is an anti-Semitic court. This is anti-Semitic media. Like everyone is anti-Semitic. And of course, you know, just offering complete support to Netanyahu, even the people who hate him the most. An exception to that has been in recent days, Moshe Bogi Yaalon, a former chief of staff, was actually the chief of staff that sent me to 2 years in prison for his war crimes, now saying, yes, these warrants are justified.
The Prime Minister. I want to go to that one minute. The clip of the former defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, accusing Israel of ethnic cleansing and committing war crimes in Gaza. Again, served as the defense minister of Netanyahu from 2013 to 16. Made the accusations over the weekend in main television interviews on Channel 12, for example, one of Israel's biggest TV channels.
To occupy, to annex, to cleanse ethnic cleansing, look at the northern Gaza Strip and settle a Jewish settlement. That's the point. There is no Beit Lahia. There is no Beit Hanon. They are operating in Jabalia and are essentially clearing the area of Arabs.
So that's a main Israeli channel, not actually Channel 12, Israel's former defense minister, Moshe Yaalon. Hagai Matar, does he speak to the Israeli public and explain more the significance of who he is?
So Yaalon was the chief of staff in the Second Intifada. That's when I refused the draft because of his war crimes. We were at the time chanting at him, one day we'll see you at The Hague. We never imagined it would be as a witness for the prosecution. To suddenly see him talking about the same sort of actions that he was doing, but clearly much, much worse right now, the ethnic cleansing things, the starvation that he's enforcing, is absolutely incredible. He's doing it as part of his attempt to fight against the Netanyahu drive for authoritarianism. So he's been very active in the kind of so-called Israeli protest for democracy, even before the war in Gaza. That has been his policy. I think he connects the dots, as one should, between the attack on democratic institutions inside of Israel and the ethnic cleansing and massacre and war crimes against Palestinians. However, unfortunately, in interviews where he's been going on Israeli television, basically from wall to wall, journalists have been saying, are you mad? You're just endangering our soldiers. What are you talking about? There's no war crimes. So because viewers don't have the context of what has actually been happening, it just sounds like a madman to many people. But I do think it does cause some people pause to think, why would someone with his credentials make such serious accusations?
We spent so much of this program talking about the diplomacy and the politics, Gideon, but I just want to turn and remember the grim reality that's going on in Gaza right now. The humanitarian situation probably as grim as it's been at any point. After 14 months of horrors, the listed death toll is about 40,000 people killed. It's probably much higher than that, but that's a staggering average of about 10,000 people killed every month for 14 months. How does it make you feel as an Israeli who for years and years and years has advocated for peace?
Before even you mentioned it, James, I wanted to mention the images that follow us while we are talking about all kinds of strategic plans. The horrible images that you just broadcasted and showed, which, by the way, are not being showed in Israel at all. And while we discuss all kinds of ideas, every day, dozens of people in Gaza are getting killed for nothing. Most of them are innocent people. Most of them are children and women. And what should I tell you? I follow it now over a year, and I must tell you that never in my life or in my career I felt so much pain, physical pain, to see those scenes, knowing that my friends, the sons of my friends and the friends of my sons, are committing those crimes.
In Canada, about 150 Jewish activists and allies have just launched a protest inside the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa to demand Canada stop arming Israel. We're joined now by Rachel Small, a member of the group Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition. Rachel, can you describe where you are and what you're doing and what you're calling for?
Thank you. We are in a Parliament Hill building. Right now, we have completely taken over the lobby of this building that has hundreds of parliamentarians' office in here. Our demand is clear. Canada needs to stop arming Israel and implement an immediate arms embargo. We know that every F-35 fighter jet, every Boeing Apache helicopter dropping bombs on Lebanon and Gaza right now is full of hundreds of Canadian components. We're here as Jews to say this violence cannot continue in our name. And we're here as people of conscience to say that the absolute bare minimum Canada needs to be doing right now is stop arming a genocide.
Hagai Matar, your response to these kinds of actions occurring abroad, does this have an impact on the Israeli public?
Well, first of all, I want to commend the activists on the ground now in Ottawa. It's incredible. This is the exact kind of protest that people should be taking on in Canada, definitely in the US, which is the biggest supplier of weapons and funding and diplomatic support to Israel. So, yes, this is what we should be seeing more of. I'm afraid that in Israel, again, these protests are usually seen as anti-Semitic, or in the case of Jews protesting, so self-hating Jews or people that are, you know, unhinged. That's the way it's being perceived. It's our job as Jewish Israelis on the ground, talking in Hebrew, talking to people in our communities, to try and help them understand that it's not the world that's gone mad. It's us.
Interesting that the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, just met with President-elect Trump in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Rachel Small, we're looking at the group of people. One of them, I think, says Jews for Free Palestine. What has been Trudeau's position and what's going to happen to you this morning?
We have seen an unprecedented wave of resistance across Canada over the past 13 months. Many, many thousands of people across the country, not only petitioning their MPs, not only protesting, not only meeting with them, but actually holding blockades at weapons factories, doing literally everything they can to get Canada to stop arming Israel. And that pressure has resulted in the Canadian government taking a stance that we would have not thought possible a year or two ago. They have committed to stop arming Israel. They have, in fact, the Foreign Affairs Minister recently, in fact, said that Canadian weapons are not going to be going and used in Gaza. Unfortunately, it's not true. Unfortunately, we know that they have not canceled all the permits, and they have continued to conveniently send weapons to the U.S. without even requiring a permit. Those are going into every F-35 Israel is using. That is going into Israel's primary weapons of war. So we have backed the Canadian government into a corner where they know what the right stance is. They know they need to stop arming Israel, and we're here to make sure they do it. The broad Arms Embargo Now coalition has come together across the country and has in fact gotten 45 parliamentarians to formally endorse the call for an arms embargo. We just need the government to step up and take that action to actually cut off the flow of all weapons to and from Israel. It's the bare minimum they need to be doing.
That's Rachel Small, member of Jews Say No to Genocide Coalition. If you're having a little trouble understanding her, she's inside the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa. There are scores of people behind her. Lead Canadian organizer with the group World Beyond War.
Last week and this week, as the ceasefire in Lebanon offers a brief pause amidst a rapidly evolving situation, we're joined by renowned expert Humayun Rabbani. I wanted to talk, initially start with, I think, the most important and most significant development that has happened, which is the ceasefire deal that has reached between Israel and Hezbollah. How do you see the ceasefire being framed by both sides?
Well, it's not a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah.
It's an agreement on the cessation of hostilities between Israel and Lebanon, in which the main counterpart is the Lebanese government rather than Hezbollah, as is common, I think, with any agreement that ends any armed conflict. Of course, all sides are claiming victory. To some extent, that's justified, and to some extent, it's not. Israel has successfully administered very severe blows to Hezbollah since September. It has eliminated virtually all of its senior leadership, particularly its military leadership. It has inflicted very widespread destruction throughout Lebanon. But at the same time, and I think it's also a primary achievement, is that if this agreement holds and continues, it would de-link what Hezbollah has termed the Lebanon support front from the Gaza Strip, and thereby deal a blow to what's called the unity of arenas. So in terms of Israel's declared war aims, de-linking Lebanon from Gaza can be chalked up as a success. But in terms of the others, there's not really much there. The residents of Israel's northern communities are refusing to return because I think Israel assumed that these very severe blows it inflicted on Hezbollah would be fatal, and that the organization could not absorb those attacks and would essentially collapse or disintegrate, and Israel just had to march into southern Lebanon and remove the remaining scattered pieces. What we saw instead was that Hezbollah was not only able to absorb these attacks that I think would have been virtually fatal to many other organizations, if not even to other states. It was able to absorb them and then made a remarkable recovery and was able to sustain its battle plan, if you will, of a coordinated gradual escalation the longer the conflict continued. So I think, you know, and it managed to inflict, I think, significant damage, not only on the Israeli military, it managed to prevent the Israeli military from advancing beyond a few kilometers into southern Lebanon, bearing in mind that in 1982, it took the same military only days to reach Beirut. And inflicted, I think, also significant damage on Israeli military infrastructure within Israel. So I think, you know, objectively, we need to see this as a draw in which both parties suffered significant losses, but also both parties managed to make some gains as well. I think for Hezbollah, primarily survival, and for Israel, primarily its ability to de-link Lebanon from Gaza, which I think is morally and politically quite significant. But practically, I don't really think that the confrontations on the northern border were in any way really significantly restraining Israel from continuing with its genocidal campaign against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. I think the other question, of course, is to what extent will this agreement persist? Israel has already launched a number of air raids into Lebanon. It has already shot up infrastructure. It has already killed a number of civilians attempting to return. And I think this is because the optics of tens of thousands of displaced Lebanese civilians returning to their homes and villages and towns in southern Lebanon, while displaced Israelis do not feel they have sufficient, that feel they have not been afforded sufficient security by their government to return to northern Israel. This is obviously something the Israeli government would rather avoid. And it's really a very vague agreement. Its implementation is unclear. There are reports of side letters, secret guarantees having been made by the United States to Israel. The long and short of which is that Israel and the United States view this as a unilateral ceasefire. In other words, that the agreement compels Lebanese parties, primarily Hezbollah, to cease all armed hostilities. But Israel, on the other hand, can continue to do as it pleases and has effectively been appointed the enforcer of a ceasefire that it is supposed to be a party of. So I don't think this is an agreement that's going to last particularly long.
What does it tell us about the political position of all the parties involved? I mean, both internally and otherwise. I feel that on a very basic term, it's like we'll come back to fight another day more than it's anything else.
Yes. Well, I think the overall purpose of this agreement, at least seen from the perspective of Israel and the United States, has been to transform the nature of the crisis from one between Israel and Hezbollah into one between Hezbollah and the Lebanese state. Mm-hmm. So if you look at what has been reported about this agreement, it's basically inviting the Lebanese army, which is, basically couldn't even take on an Israeli battalion. It is inviting the Lebanese army to succeed where the full might of the U.S. armed and supplied Israeli military has failed. And that's quite clearly a non-starter. What I think its purpose is to seek to create a political crisis within Lebanon, between Hezbollah and the Lebanese state, in the hope that the Lebanese state will then be supported by not only the military, but also Hezbollah's domestic adversaries, in order to kind of sap also the social base of Hezbollah and use this to seek to clip the movement's wings. Again, that's a strategy that would have made sense if Hezbollah had proven unable to absorb the blows that were administered to it in September, October, or had collapsed and disintegrated. But that's not the case at all. And I think both Hezbollah and Israel, and of course Lebanon, are thus far cooperating with the implementation of this agreement to one degree or another, because all of them, I think, have sustained significant losses. All of them need a respite, a breather. But at the end of the day, I think, like you, everyone concerned, and I would argue also very many of those who are observing this from afar, see it indeed as a breather, if you will, of an agreement to pause rather than end the armed confrontation.
To zoom out a bit, there are a few events that happened in Jordan towards Israel. I think there was the truck driver who shot two soldiers a while back, amongst a couple of other things. Do you think there's enough instability between Arab regimes and the Arab population that would materialize into something that would play a factor in this conflict?
Over the longer term, that's entirely likely. In the short term, it's unlikely, though. Who knows? I mean, I think we could, in some respects, compare the present moment to the Nakba in 1948. As you may recall, in the decade after the Nakba, there was massive instability throughout the Arab East. There was There was, of course, the whole series of military coups in Syria, the Jordanian monarchy, and the Lebanese state were almost overthrown on account of opposition and uprisings. Most prominently, of course, the Egyptian monarchy was overthrown and replaced by the revolutionary nationalist regime of Gamal Abdel Nasser. And this culminated in 1958 with the overthrow of the Hashemite monarchy in Iraq. I think there's a fundamental difference between then and now. And of course, I'm not suggesting that this was all because of Palestine, but I think most historians who've carefully looked into these see Palestine as a significant contributor to developments in the Middle East during the 1950s. So in 1948 and thereafter, people rose up against their governments or opposed them, or military officers tried to overthrow their rulers, not only because of the Nakba and what had happened to Palestine, but because their governments, their militaries, had directly intervened in support of the Palestinians against the nascent Israeli state and failed miserably. So they were responding to the abject failure of their own rulers as much as they were responding to what had happened in the to the Palestinians in 1948. The situation today is significantly different. The issue is not that Arab governments have tried and failed to support the Palestinians. They haven't even tried. They've effectively looked the other way. Those who maintain relations with Israel have done absolutely nothing to curtail these relations. There has been, for example, not even withdrawals of ambassadors and so on. And so the close relations with Israel, the close relations with the United States and other countries that are arming and supporting this genocide have been absolutely unaffected. And so to me, the unanswered question is, as we look ahead in the months, but more likely years ahead, will the Arabs of today feel more aggrieved because their governments, because their rulers did absolutely nothing? Or would they have been more aggrieved if their governments had actually tried and failed as they did in 1948? And this to me is something of an unanswered question. But regardless, I find it very difficult to conclude that the role, or non-role if you prefer, that Arab governments and rulers have played during the past year is going to be without consequence.
That's it for this hour. On today's show, we focus on Canadian media's willful blindness when it comes to the realities of Palestinians under occupation. We then looked at the Israeli government's aims in Gaza and the Israeli media's role in the support that the Israeli society still gives to this war, even with the toll it's taken on their own country. In the second part of the show, we covered the Ottawa protest, demanding the Canadian government to stop supplying weapons to Israeli military. Then we looked at the fragility of the ceasefire reached in Lebanon last week. And finally, we looked at the inaction of the Arab governments and the potential long-term consequences of this inaction. If you missed parts of the show, you can go to CKUT's website at CKUT.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find us. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at CFRC.ca. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free Palestine.